Hi, and welcome to Backstage at Architect Insight 2010. And it's a great pleasure to have Andy Hopkirk with me from the National Computing Centre.
That's right.
And Andy, you've just done a keynote here this morning, and it was a really fascinating subject where you kind of put yourself in the position of the customer or the client talking to the architect, what they expect, almost having a charter of what you commit to the architect and what you expect from them in return. But also, you gave us a view of the whole work you've done around eGIF, the government interoperability framework, over the past few years. And really, I think it'd be good to kind of get a view of what's the lessons learnt over that sort of period of time, over the last 10 years, in working in this space in government.
Yeah, well, in a nutshell, I think the main lesson is that architecture is really important, and architecture was underappreciated, and as a consequence of that, things have been done that in retrospect you might have done in a different order or have done in a different way. The whole e-government interoperability framework and the whole thrust of activity around interoperability was because interoperability was seen to be the way to create these new systems, join up all these systems that were already in place, and manage how you were going to integrate new ones into the old. That seemed to be the solution to the problem.
Yeah.
So in 1999, when modernizing government was the policy announcement, the implementation action, if you like, that lay behind that policy closely after was all this stuff about interoperability. So we set off on a journey for the next, almost 10 years now, doing stuff to promote and help people get their heads around what interoperability is about.
So
that led to a load of consequences. Some things went well, other things didn't go quite so well. So on reflection, when you look back on the things that didn't quite go so well, or some of the things that did go well but could have gone further and deeper, the bit that was missing was some kind of overarching, if you like, architectural vision for what it was that was to be built, and some clear metrics of how you would know when you were actually achieving this vision that you had articulated in 1999.
So you kind of had a mandate, you had this interoperability or integration requirement, I guess, was the upshot from previous governments. You have a set
of for example, the e-government interoperability framework was mandated across the whole of the public sector. But the mandation was not enough to get everybody on board, because people will only come on board if they share the vision.
Yes.
So the bit that was missing was the work to articulate the vision.
So the selling of the vision.
Yeah.
So and the vision was there, I get. Well, the need to integrate.
The need was there.
Yeah.
But what wasn't crystal clear in everyone's mind was what it was they were trying to build.
Right.
Everybody had a different view of what e-government was.
Yes.
Then it became transformational government. So everybody had their own view of what transforming government was. We now have the latest initiative, which is we're going to personalise government services. You might call it MyGov, I think it's the term that's being used. These are all transitions which are not accidental. They're part of the sort of natural progression of how you might go about these things. But the guiding architecture, the guiding structure, is not uppermost in everyone's minds when they're making the decisions about how to align with trend A or trend B or implement policy A in situation Z.
So these frameworks, who are they? Who owns them, or is it a, you know, is there a kind of an architectural group that's is responsible for sort of seeing them implemented and adhered to, or?
Well, the original eGIF came about as a very open and consultative exercise. The then Office of the Envoy got together a group called the Interoperability Working Group. They were charged with the task of defining what were the key policies, the key technical standards, and whether or not they should be recommended at various levels of significance to be adopted into the eGIF. And then there was a process for regular review of those and other processes for creating the new standards that didn't exist. I mean, there are standards that public sector and public services people care deeply about, but nobody else cares about them. So it's a task that the public sector itself has to take on, the mm-hmm. development and the curation and ultimately the retirement and replacement of the standards for themselves.
But you seem to be saying that you well, not you personally, but they'd been developed by these kind of cross-government groups or whatever,
yeah.
But they weren't adopted. Is that the outcome, that people weren't actually using them because they... nobody had sort of explained the reason why they should?
Well, I think that's maybe not quite the right way to
right.
put it. The standards themselves were often adopted because if you're implementing a system X in situation Y, the right standard will be this rather than that one. So why would you not use the right standard? What the framework set out to do was not to, in a sense, be prescriptive about you must use this standard
yeah.
in this situation, because that would be impossible. There's an infinity of situations and hundreds if not thousands of standards, so the prescription would be so big it would be impossible to produce it, and it'd be out of date the minute you produced it. So what the framework did was set out a whole series of, if you like, policies to adhere to, practices that were good practice rather than bad practice. And if you moved within the space that was defined by that framework, then you were compliant with the requirements of being in the framework. So it was an error on people's part to think that the eGIF was a standard.
Yes.
And in a sense, that was a marketing failure on the part of those who were promulgating the eGIF.
Right.
It's still referred to today as, I hear it all the time, the eGIF standard. You have to say, no, it is not a standard. It is a framework containing policies and recommendations about certain standards
yes.
at a point in time.
Right. And so so the adoption of this has been fairly widespread, then, you seem to be saying. Where's the problem? Or is there a problem? Or is it, how can... one learn from the experiences of this time?
Well, many, many systems have been implemented and many, many projects have come and gone. And part of the e-government plan, if you like, or the to which the eGIF was just one small set, was about getting people into a way of thinking and into a way of behaving. So now the space of interoperability is much better understood and recognized than it was before, because people are more familiar with it. Even if they weren't complying with the eGIF, many people knew that there was an eGIF that they were not complying with.
Right.
So there were interoperability expectations, there were policies that were recommended practice. It was always the case that you could choose not to follow the policies and the standards. The eGIF allowed you to not follow the recommendations, but what it required you to do was to justify your requirement to be an exception. So in that sense, it was a very liberal space.
Yeah.
It was saying, come into the gang, let's all work together, we'll share common standards, we'll build systems together, we'll have a philosophy that we're going to make things open and interoperable. But if for some reason that isn't where you have to be, then that's okay. But say so, and then justify it, and then we'll leave you alone. We won't hassle you anymore about being in the group.
That's very progressive, because that's architectures and architects being seen as enablers is clearly what we've seen kind of more broadly across the kind of profession over the years. It's not about saying you can't do this, it's about saying, well, here's things that we've seen work well in these cases, providing guidance and rather than
it was all very well to say that here is a collection of technical standards and a collection of policies, and if you follow these you will make a more interoperable system. But the vision of having joined up services, having the ability to manage change more quickly, more flexibly, more cheaply. That's a bigger vision than just interoperability. And when you look at these other missing elements, you find that those other missing elements, when gathered together as a set, are what people call the enterprise architecture. Hence, as we move from e-government into transformational government, the key thing that really lay behind transformation for me was this explicit recognition that architecture was something that had to be tackled.
Mm.
It wasn't enough just to everything. Mm-hmm. It wasn't enough just to make things interoperable. There had to be an overarching structure within which all these changes were being made.
Mm.
Otherwise, the changes were incoherent.
And you mentioned now it's moving to kind of the personalized view or MyGov, and to what Dave Kaplan was saying earlier on around this move to open gov and open data government and all that sort of stuff, and the advent of cloud and everything else, sort of wanting to kind of liberate the data.
Yeah.
Where do we go from where we are? Is our government systems, are they based on an interoperability layer now that allows us to just take advantage of these new platforms, or is there work to be done? And back to the point about the architect, how can those architects, what's the role of that architect, those architects, in ensuring the success, seeing that vision, the bigger vision delivered, as opposed to let's deliver interoperability, because it's not a delivery on its own.
One of the successes, if you wanted to call it that, of the transition from e-government to transformational government, was a very explicit recognition that there was a role of two kinds of people that was very clear. There was what you call the chief technical officer, the CTOs. Mm. That became the CTO council. There was a group of people who would be consulted and who would make recommendations and wise decisions on topics of technology. Equally, there was a recognition that the CIO role was something that had to sort of be established more firmly. Mm-hmm. So there's now, 10 years later, a whole gang of people who would call themselves CIOs, and they meet together as a CIO council in the mm-hmm. public sector to talk about things at a CIO level. This is great, that's great, but I would contend that the CIOs and the CTOs have their roles to fulfill, but there's still this other role of envisaging what the future is going to be like, and then organizing and systematically setting about the process of building it. Now, part of some of the people who would actually do the building would be the CIOs, the CTOs, and the IT teams in the various departments. But they're all working to a blueprint that's not drawn by any one of them alone. The blueprints, I would contend, have to be drawn by someone who has an architectural view of the whole thing that they're trying to build.
Mm.
And he or she would be a very special person. But we know that architects are special. It's very difficult to be an architect. It's a long, hard training to be an architect. So for me, this is perhaps the lesson of the last 10 years. You can have lots of skilled people doing good work using the tools of the trade, but if they're not working to some common vision that's very clear, articulated by an architect, you get lots of stuff, but it doesn't necessarily all add up to what you thought it was you were all building, because it was never clear.
Yeah.
So I think the architecting the business of public services is where the next challenge is, if you like, establishing that role, so that we can turn round and say this large departmental process set has been re-architected to these ends by these contractors under the guidance of this group of people called the architects. For the client, and the client is the CIO or the CTO and the other business process owners inside those departments.
And I guess the way that government or IT is sort of built up, a lot of it's sourced by suppliers, different layers. Would those architects reside in those entities, or would they be, a group within, like the CTOs and CIOs? Would there be kind of government-based architect roles, do you see?
Well, that's an interesting question. If we take the building services analog, the person who commissions the building doesn't employ the architect as an impermanent employee. He or she puts the opportunity to build me a building out to the wider world, and architects pitch to me, the client, for their vision of how they are going to create what I need to create. And they'll have some sort of discussion with me in order to tease out what it is I really want, and then they'll formulate a view.
Yes.
Then if I select you as my architect, then I expect you to then go off and help me manage the process of selecting the contractors, negotiating the prices, actually doing all the detailed implementation work. And then to stretch the analogy a little bit further, I'll ask for you as the architect to sign off on the end result. Because you're working for me as the client.
Yeah, I guess for me the analogy with the building architect kind of breaks down at that point, if I'm honest with you, because the benefits of physical world objects is they have a number of rules and laws that govern them, plus they're built upon regular objects that anybody would know, whereas you know the issues with the abstract virtual world of IT is that so much of the assets are you know, their bricks of very different shapes, you know, and no brick is the same. Now the interoperability elements give you an ability to kind of stick them together, absolutely, and that probably provides some definition of how to stick things together. But you still need to know, it's not like, okay, I know cement's used every time, it's each time there's a different sort of cement used. So although it may be an open standard cement, it's still the flavour is different.
Yeah.
The analogy is terrible. So my issue with that would be that bringing the architect in to do the job, they'll do a good sales job potentially, but when it gets down to the reality, they'll just be looking at these bricks and going, how do they fit together? Because the documentation will never be perfect. You know, we know about standards documentation at best.
Yeah. Just to stretch the analogies a little bit further for the purposes of it, you say you might just get a good sales pitch from the architect. That's true. A good architect
will do their best to say, I can build this for you, as a good architect would.
But the key test of the architect is what has he already built.
Mm. But this comes back to the problem that the bricks aren't the same each time.
Well,
I mean, you know, yes, there's experience, and yeah, absolutely. And to that point, how do you measure success and experience, you know?
Well, if you look at a great architect and a great architectural practice, they build many and various objects out of thousands of individual components that can be joined together in millions of different ways to produce products which are, each is unique. You can point at that building and say that architect built that.
But they're based on the physical principles which are consistent, and that's the issue in the virtual world of IT. There's just no barriers, there's no boundaries that mean previous constructs are based upon anything that you would be able to picture or understand just by looking at the specification.
Yeah.
You know, well, the semantics of specifications, we all know the issues there that you know, just because it has an API with a, you know, taking an inter and a string, what's the semantic usage of that inter and string? You don't often have that clarity of information in order that you can plug these things together. Now, that might improve. But you need to have the experience within the context of the previous buildings, need to be within the context of the new ones, would be my comment.
But all that is very good. But if you zoom out, you've still got a client who wishes something to be made which is different from what they have now. So we need a chain of conversations to realize the new reality. Now, that chain runs both ways. It comes back to us as the client. We have to be clear about what we want, and we'll set the metrics for what we want. So in public service, for example, my requirement might be I want to have broader and deeper engagement with my public community, or I need to cut my budget for running the processes that I run by 20%. That's a very concrete metric to me. It's the job of the architect to hear that message and then take their professional knowledge about what all the componentry can do to then work with the contractors to join things together in whatever way they need to be done, to come back to me and say, this is the product. And I will measure the quality of the product by how much it fulfills my vision, which to the architect and to the contractors might be very simplistic and actually intangible. but they're very tangible to me.
Yes, and I agree with that, absolutely. But the key I'll come back to again is that architect needs to have the previous contextual knowledge of the the implementations for that system or problem domain.
Yeah.
You can't get an architect off the shelf and expect them to be able to do that, whereas in the physical world of buildings, you can potentially do that, so they've done buildings of that kind of type before. So would you say that the architects would reside within the government organisation or outside in the...
Yeah.
Or would it be a mixture?
I think the point I was making, which we didn't get to, was that the relatively small organisations have no need for a permanently employed architect.
Mm.
Very large and complicated organisations that are always moving probably would benefit from having an in-house architect. But the big danger of having in-house is that you then get the groupthink.
Yeah.
You don't get the imagination of seeing things differently. So if you could take an architect from this domain over here to bring their expertise and insight and knowledge and an ability to envision a different future and apply it to my domain over here, then I would speculate that I may get a more innovative solution than one that would come from the people who are inside that I see every day.
Yeah, and absolutely. And that's always a challenge of how do you get the benefits of the lessons learned by other individuals. And I think there's a role for professional associations in that. There's other groups. And I think as you think about those systems, the kind of multi-sourcing model that's been talked about a few times over the couple of days, where you can see that you're going to be taking services from different suppliers, then by natural consequence, you have to, as the architect there, be collaborating with those architects on the supplier side. And that's perhaps where you start to get the knowledge share.
Yeah.
But retaining the context and the knowledge of what you already have, because it's that's so hard to kind of just... that's why architects spend a long time, because they learn that over a long period of time of being involved.
And that's why I need my architect to be my champion.
Yeah,
because I don't understand this stuff in depth, but my architect does.
Yeah.
So my architect is my right hand person, my extra brain, to protect me from the costly and expensive snake oil that looks attractive but isn't actually going to do the job that it said it was going to do.
Yes, so and I would absolutely agree with that.
Yeah. So yes. I think professionalising the role of the architect in this domain that we live in, which is things to do with IT and communications technologies, is early days.
Hmm.
It can take a very long time to establish a profession, but every journey step, starts with the first step. So in the time I've been involved in this, I've seen architecture come to the fore as something that needs to be done. Well, the next step is, how do I find someone who's competent at doing this?
Mm.
Now, at the moment, that might be quite difficult because these people don't really identify themselves as being architects in the sense that I'm talking about. But over time, then that situation could change. And any professionalising of the activity from a client point of view is a good thing, because I want to deal with a professional to give me a professional quality job. So if I can't go to the place where professionals gather together because it doesn't exist, then I have a problem. And as I say, that seems to be going away, in that the profession is organising and different people have different initiatives in different places. And all I can say is explore the space, but please explore it quickly and consolidate on something which makes it easy for the client to know where they stand.
That's fantastic and so interesting, and it's a subject dear to my heart as well. And I think, over the last 10 years, longer, the word architects has kind of been emerging and growing, and now I think it's just getting to that tipping point where the CIO, the CTO are actively engaged in two-way discussions with that type of role. And I think we need to kind of formalize the role, but, you know, put some more sort of descriptions around it.
Yeah.
And the professionalization of it is critical.
Yeah, I think and architects themselves as people need to kind of stand up and fly the flag for what they do.
Mm.
As a society, we recognize great architecture. So why not recognize great architecture of this nature? Why
Absolutely.
Not?
Absolutely. No, I'm with you on that. And I guess that's what our Architect Insight's all about, in a sense for me, is about celebrating the work that these people are and we do, you know.
Yeah. Yes, please. More. Carry on.
Great. Well, right. Andy, thanks so much for talking to me, and very fascinating, and great to hear this sort of story unfolding, and to see it from your perspective, and certainly what's happening in government. It's amazing to, and how that matches and mirrors what's happening in private sector as well is great to hear.
Yeah. Right. Thank you.
Thank you.